Welcome
Blog
to the Method
Radio.
Welcome to the Method and the Muse. Writers, are you stuck or blocked or inspired on a roll and tearing it up? Is your latest accomplishment publicizing your most recent bestseller, finishing the 265th revision of your first poem, or just making the commitment to writing? Whatever your state of mind, this show is for you. The Method and the Muse is all about what happens at the writer's desk. Our conversations with writers from all categories and genres will give you plenty of ideas for firing up your own writing life as you're sharpening your craft. We dig deep here into one or two key techniques of our guests and what inspires them in their writing. This month's episode features author Robert Maggio. He lives in Nashville with his wife, Kat, and trusty Pomeranian. His fiction appears here and there, including Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine, the Mystery Writers of America anthology, Ice Cold, and the Audeville Press. When not writing, he counts things or can be found wandering the snack food aisles. More information, by the way, can be found on his website at robertmangeot.com. Hello, Robert.
Hey. Nice to see you.
Good to see you. Can I call you Bob?
You absolutely may.
Oh, that's great. That's great, Bob. I'm really excited about you kicking off our new show, The Method and the Muse. This is produced by WON, Writers Online Network Radio, as part of their programming. And more information, by the way, is available for WON at www.writersonlinenetwork.com and also can be found on Facebook and Twitter at WON underscore radio and at Writers on Net. Well, just introducing you is exciting because I love mysteries and I love short stories, and I'm glad you're my first guest. You won several awards, it's my understanding, for your writing, in addition to getting published and short stories published. And so tell me, Bob, how did an accountant move to the world of mystery short stories?
The long way, I would So, you know, I think if you go back to growing up, what did I grow up around was, a lot of mysteries. And so, I Hawaii Five-O and all the shows that were kind of on back then, you grew up around it. And what did I grow up reading was, the classic mysteries. My parents both loved them. And they used to take us kids to the University of Louisville, had a movie theater there, and every so often they would do like vintage films or whatever, and they would take us to Casablanca or to see the Maltese Falcon, so Humphrey Bogart, right? Mm-hmm. And apparently that influence stuck because it kind of, I write in all genres, but it's the mystery ones that seem to find the nicest homes, I guess I should say. And it never occurred to me I wouldn't write some of that stuff. It's just, when you think about crime, for example, and I write more crime probably than mystery, but what's more human than the crimes that people commit or that they choose not to commit, right? And so you can totally explore that a lot and forever, and it's fun to do. You write a bad criminal. It's a hilarious exercise, an empowering exercise to do.
And you blend, my understanding is you blend crime, humor, and Southern fiction.
Yeah, I try. I call it my writing triangle, my writing space. And so on one point is humor, which is I very few of my pieces don't have that at some level, whether dark or light. Crime, and then the third point is literary, but it tends to happen in the South or sometimes in France, and we can talk about that in a little bit.
Okay.
But then I write anywhere in between. And so it could be a literary story that's kind of funny. It could be a crime story that's kind of dark. It could be a Southern story that, but that's how I find, at the method part of the show, that's how I help myself create rather than be wide open and never, it gets too big, right? And so I know what I'm good at and I have fun doing. Doesn't mean I don't experiment, but there's infinite space within that for me to experiment.
And with your analytical accountant mind, I'm sure that helps with the mysteries and being able to hone in on that.
A little bit. It helps probably more in the editing. I can get very spreadsheety about them. No, I was an accountant for in healthcare finance, various roles for a long time. It's one of those things that you dabbled in writing a little bit growing up, and in college, I was a humor columnist. He was the managing editor in the school paper, although, Bellarmine College, wonderful university now, Bellarmine University. Wonderful institution. But the school paper just wasn't that big back in the day. I had a choice between, pursuing a kind of journalism sort of angle or an accounting sort of angle. Okay, the accountant in me was very much alive back then. What paid better? Who was hiring more? But when you do that, when you make a choice like that, the other side of you doesn't go away. And so over a period of time, this little voice was saying, you were good at writing something. You should write something. Mm-hmm. It would just whisper it. You should write something. You should write something. You should write something. After a while, it starts to, get louder and louder and louder until finally it was screaming, write something.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. And it totally rediscovered this whole part of me that I've just treasured now that has come out in the last, 5-10 years or so.
Well, that's very exciting. And I've loved reading several of your short stories. And I'm a big Alfred Hitchcock fan, so I especially was excited to see you in that particular magazine. I will tell any listeners out there that the last 10 minutes of the show, you are welcome to call in. So around 5:20 Central, 6:20 Eastern. The number you can call in is on the website, but it's also 1-917-889-8080. And if you could wait and hold off, he may answer your questions before you need to ask them. But if he doesn't, about 5:20, you can give us a call, and hopefully you'll come on through. So let's talk a little bit about the method. This is the method part. We'll get to the muse, which is the broad, fun, kind of sexy part of writing. But the method portion is so very important. And what we do on the method and the muse, we don't talk about five different things in the 30 minutes. We try to focus in on one or two key areas that writer is going to address from their perspective, how they do it. And the first thing we wanted to talk a little bit about is how a writer finds their voice, the voice of the story. And tell us a little bit about your thoughts about that. And if you want to read us an example, feel free to do that.
Yeah. So think of voice in two levels. There's the writer's voice, which is the thing that's distinctly them. It's or me or you or whoever. It's the sum total of our perspectives, our life experiences, our style, the way we kind of like to write. And I love to have fun with style. I think it's a mark in some of my stories. But it's the sound that's consistently you. It flows across so many stories. George Singleton's a short story writer. I don't know if you've ever read his stuff. He can actually be quite dark, and that's some of the stories, but he's typically hilarious Southern stuff, and it's just so well written. But you always know it's one of his stories. So in music, right, if a Rolling Stones song came on, it's them. They might be doing a country song or a rock song, but right?
Mm-hmm.
A Beck song, he's all over the place, but you always know mm-hmm. it's a Beck song. So that's at the authorial level. There are as many ways to find that voice as there are people trying to write, but it really all boils down to one thing, and that's getting in the chair and staying in the chair. There's the famous author's expression that you have to write a million words or whatever before you're any good at it. The accountant in me again. I don't know if the number should be 100,000 or 250,000 or whatever, but for every person, there is a number you have to put in the time. There's no shortcut to that.
Right.
And so I call it the million purposeful words, that you don't just sit down at a computer and just mm-hmm. bang out something, although at some stage that's probably what you're doing. In some days when you can't think straight, that's what you're doing anyway.
Right.
But they need to be purposeful words because you're driving yourself toward finding what's distinctly you and what you're trying to say. I'm not sure I'm always trying to say something, but knowing that. And so that's at the authority level. The second level is the narrative level. And so this is where you're coming outside of yourself and you're now going to share something of that with the reader. Because remember, when you're writing a story or a novel or a poem, and you're intending to get it published or to go to a coffee shop and read it or something like that, it's not just your story anymore. It's the reader's story just as much as yours. And so this is where the narrative voice comes in and has to harmonize, because particularly in short stories where every element kind of wraps around a whole that is the little kernel of the story, you have to find the unique voice that serves that. And maybe a first-person voice, it may be a third-person voice. You know, you can have all kinds of different narrative distances, but it all has to blend. And I'll tell you a quick little story, and then I'll read a little bit, hopefully, about that.
Before you get into that, I did want to mention that one of my favorite of your short stories I've read is First Rodeo. And to not give it away, I just wondered, you described it, the voice of the dad as the jaundiced voice of the father. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, just that, okay, so I can't talk too much about the story because it's all about the twist at the end, but it is about a little boy, you know, what's the famous expression, it ain't my first rodeo? Okay, but for somebody at some point on Sunday, it's their first rodeo, and so I just thought that was a funny idea to explore. And so the story is about a little boy going to his first rodeo. And it's told from the perspective of the dad, who's effectively initiating his son into the rodeo experience. And he speaks with this sort of tired pride that, you know, it's kind of a light story, but, you know, he's not the nicest guy. His son thinks he is, and he probably thinks he is. But one of the voices I do pretty well is the kind of wry narrator, and he speaks a lot of that. And so to create something like that, this is where narrative voice comes in. You know, you might see a flower and think it's pretty. He's going to see a flower and think, you know, I'm making something up here that it, you know, it's going to wilt, or right, somebody just needs to weed that or something
right.
like that.
Right,
and it doesn't help that he starts the story on a 5-alarm hangover, and so that kind of sets the.
That's not a good way for any of us to start our
story. You don't start a day that way at all.
Oh, that's right. And so you were going to share.
So in a story I did for an anthology for Nashville Writers Meetup Group, the story is called Dark Days for the Professor, and it's a really good exercise. I think I like to read from it because it's just fun, and that's really kind of what the story is mostly about, is fun. But it took me 3 major cracks to get the voice right. I got about 1,000 words into draft one, and, you know, okay, draft one's never going to be any good. But I got into it and said, not only is the story not going where I want it to, but neither is the voice. This narrator is just dead. And so I deleted it. And so then I started back over with the story just from scratch, and I got about 3,500 words in, and it was better, but it was not very good. So 3,500 words, I mean, you got an investment at that point.
And you scratched it?
I deleted the whole, every last one of it.
You killed your children, as they say.
Yeah, and yeah. I started again for the third time, and that time I got it. And you just kind of know. You just,
right.
Other writers who are on who are listening, you know when you got the voice of the story down. And so I pursued it, and so I just want to read a little bit of it. And to set it up, the story is about a guy named Tyson Augur V. So, okay, now you know it's going to be a little bit of what kind of a story it's going to be. And he's the 5th generation son of a rural soft drink company that kind of got founded Riverside back in the old, you know, Cheerwine days, if anybody knows what I'm talking about. And the company has attempted to modernize, but under his watch, not very well. And so the world has basically passed this company by, and it's kind of his fault. He's just now waking up to it.
Okay.
So I'm going to read a little bit of it here. And this is near the beginning where they're driving off to meet some investment bankers who he hopes are going to rescue the company. But, of course, he has no idea how to deal with investment bankers. And so, Jamar took the county road past the bottling plant. It was June, and lightning bugs drifted around in the professor's elderberry patch. On evenings like this, Ty Augers 1 through 4 had probably stood up there surveying that Tennessee horizon, thinking it rolled on forever, never dreaming someday Nashville would scale all those hills. Jamar shook his head slowly. Sad day when a Ty Augers sells off the professor. I told you, I'm only dangling these hedge fund people limited partner shares. And dragging me into it, how am I supposed to face Mama Auger now? I considered that problem in silence. The Sunday evening church set avoided dive bars, at least until Monday, and the truckers had switched the new travel center off the highway. That left bygones to us, the hardcore regulars, in a musky, everything-off-the-scene griddle aroma that had taken hold. Big Dave the bartender said Esperanza had called ahead and that the deck was ours all night. I ordered four roses neat and asked if he'd change the radio to adult alternatives. Big Dave said he would. Out back, Jamar had grabbed the picnic table overlooking the Duck River. He was drinking a chilled professor, and on the siding above him was an antique sign displayed an old-timey fellow toasting no one in particular with a black-red beverage. Proud to serve Professor Fizzbang, the sign declared. Good Southern Sippin' Cola. This passive-aggressive angle to Jamar needed stamping out fast. What, I said, you think I like doing this? The citronella torches and cicadas cheering heightened the drama in his crook eyes. There's not wanting to and there's not minding. In case you didn't notice, you can't even bring yourself to sip on a professor in front of investors. I regretted turning over the rock of Jamar's passive aggressiveness. All right, so maybe I don't mind. I nodded toward the hills looming up across the river. Heat, humidity, pollen, anything that nature can inflict, it pools here. This valley traps augers. Once me keeled over, reviving a cola that's been out of the national consciousness since Kennedy. Have to try hard before you keel over. I'll stop there, but there's
that's fun.
Yeah, there's more there. It's a fun story, and it speaks to kind of what I try to do, because there even begins to get a little crime angle to it later on. But
well, I know when I was reading about that story too, you had said when you were writing about it that you, for him, you wanted him to be Southern but not a stereotyped redneck. And I think that's something all of us authors struggle with, is not feeding into stereotypes, but there is a ring of truth to a stereotype. If you can take just a second before we move to our next topic.
I think that's absolutely right. That, you know, that, again, there is a ring of truth to stereotypes. Mm-hmm. So if you start down kind of a trope path, mm-hmm. one of the secrets is, you know, a trope is just as good or bad as you use them.
Right.
And one of the ways that to use them really well is to not go all the way, is to say, okay, this guy's going to be pretty Southern. He's going to be kind of a good old boy running a company, but he's going to have other aspects to him that really make him a three-dimensional character. So I think once you get into three-dimensional characters, you make choices and they have feelings. They do things that aren't just
all bad or all good.
Right. Mm-hmm. You get some depth to them.
Right.
I think that's where literature really just really takes off. And hopefully that's where he took off as a character.
Well, we're going to do just a very short time before we move into the muse portion, because I don't want to neglect the muse. The muse would be very offended if we did. So the other little area we're going to dig into a little bit is what you had said is ending in short stories is everything.
Yeah.
So tell us what that means.
Yeah, so a couple of sayings that I think if you have a really good hook, and a hook in a short story, remember, it's like one paragraph or two paragraphs, mm-hmm. that you don't have time in short stories. A really good hook will get an editor's attention. The ending is what's going to sell it. And I'm pretty sure that my stories that got in Ice Cold and the two that have been Hitchcock, they all start really, really well, but they end in some cases with a twist or with an inevitability or whatever. But I bet you if I sat down with each of the editors, they'd say, yep, it was the ending that was the reason we wanted your story.
Mm-hmm.
So short stories, if you think about them, are kind of ending delivery systems. Here's the accountant me coming back down.
ending
delivery systems.
That sounds pretty clinical,
so,
Bob.
Right.
You're
well,
to make it
but craft, if you're not thinking about craft in writing, then your words are accidental.
You are right.
And you cannot write accidentally. Anybody can accidentally write a good story.
Correct.
But see, when I'm writing, I think we're getting to the muse part. I think about how I'm writing as much as what I'm writing, because if I'm if I'm writing well, I will produce good writing and better writing over time. So ending delivery systems, because remember, stories, virtually all of them, are going to be read in one sitting. And so not only are you compressing time in the story, the reader's expecting it. And they want to know, they will, if it's not a whole, if it's not a unity of effect, like look up, he's an obscure writer named Edgar Allan Poe. He had a theory about unity of effect. You can go look it up. We don't have time to talk about it today. But every element in a story revolves around one effect you're trying to achieve. And if you don't do that as a short story writer, the reader's going to notice because they just read the thing front to back in 15 minutes.
Right.
They're going to notice. And so you can do a lot of things with the ending, but it has to have what I call the resonant moment.
Resonant moment.
The resonant moment, which is where, or the big honking moment, whatever. But where the story has reached its natural ending, but it's all in a way its highest moment. It might be the character's lowest moment, but from a dramatic perspective, or even comedic perspective, the highest moment. As I liken it to where a short story ends is a lot like when you go to a jazz performance or a symphony performance, even a rock performance, and the band has stopped playing, but for those 5 seconds or those 15 seconds, there's still that music is just in the room. You know what I mean? It's just that ghost of the music. And you want to leave the reader with that. You can do it with a twist, although if you don't set it up well, you can cheapen the story.
Right.
You can do it in the culmination of a journey. And I've done a lot of these in different ways. I wrote a story called The Transcendence of Pi. It was one of the contest winners. And it was a self-revelation. It wasn't a twist. It was a self-revelation. The reader knew it all along. It was satire. It was the narrator catching up to the reader.
Oh, that's fun. That's fun.
And kind of the inevitability of fate, which is noir, which I really don't do a great job with. But then there's The Journey Completed, which is The Sparks of the Bear's Hide, which is In the Ice Cold. There's A Shift for the Better, and I've written several of those stories. And then there's Height of Uncertainty. I actually like leaving the reader with questions because I think it helps that moment. You don't have to tie up every little piece. You just have to find that really powerful moment and end there.
And I think for short stories or novels, I prefer where everything is not neatly tied up because life is not that way. And it seems more real to me if everything isn't all tied up in a bow and given to you as a present. I totally agree. Because we are running short on time, I'm going to go ahead and let's move to a little bit more to the muse portion. And anyone can call in if they would like. The number is 1-917-889-8080. Feel free to call. Hopefully I will connect up with you. If I don't, we will hopefully talk again on our next show, which is, by the way, the third Monday of each month at 5 o'clock Central Time. Okay, for the muse portion, you've told us a little bit already about what inspires you as a writer, what keeps you going, what motivates you, what's your muse, who do you admire, who do you read when you want to feel inspired to write?
Yeah, a couple of names, particularly on short stories. I mentioned George Singleton a lot. It's really helpful to, and I recommend this to anybody, particularly newer writers, to when you find like for me, it's Ben Fountain. I don't know if you've ever read anything about Ben Fountain, but he's his novel is the long half, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, and they're making a movie out of it. And his short story collection is called Brief Encounters with Che Guevara, and it is just so brilliant. Like, you want to write that well. So it's inspiring, but you also connect to it. And so if you take one of those, take one of his stories apart, okay, how did he do that? And you just take it apart and try to learn dynamics, and one of two things are going to happen. You'll be sitting there working on somebody else's words, and you're either going to learn something and get really inspired and go run to the computer and start typing, and it will sound totally like you, not like them.
Right.
So either that will happen, or you'll get so sick of editing, of analyzing someone else's story, you will be bored and you will want to go to the computer and start typing.
Right.
But I even keep, like, when a passage sings to me, I'll mark it in the book. And then I will go back every now and again and just look at those passages that sing to me. And boy, they really get you inspired, because there's, life is life and it's hard sometimes. And you sit down at the computer and you're worn out. And how do you get yourself ready to write? And that's a question every writer needs to answer, because life is going to try to take that time. How do you protect it, and how do you get yourself ready to use it well?
How do you set up your actual physical space to be inspired to write?
Probably not as well as I should, but I'll tell you a little bit about. So I have an office at the house, and all I do in there is writing. And I have my books and everything on that. And when I'm deep in writing, there'll be paper everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I have my desk. I have a big thing. And I don't necessarily listen to music, because typically there's like a cat climbing on me. And that's one distraction. We have a caller, so we can.
Yes, we have a caller. Who do I have on the line? You can give your first name or your whole name if you wish.
Hello, is that me now?
Yes.
Hello?
Who is?
Oh,
yes, hello.
Okay. Yeah. I wondered if we could just touch a little bit more on that unity of effect. That's a concept I didn't exactly grab too well.
Unity of effect.
Okay.
All right. Thank
mm-hmm.
you, Paula.
Thank
okay,
you.
So thank you. Edgar Allan Poe, who, among other things, wrote a whole bunch of short stories that a lot of people still read and buy a lot of today, he said that before you start writing a short story, you should pick one emotional effect you were trying to bring out of a reader. Now, you can say that's oversimplifying it, and you want to have it be much more complex than that, because he would say it's like dread or fear mm-hmm. or joy. For me, that's a little bit oversimplified, but of course he's Edgar Allan Poe. I'm not going to argue too much with that. I wouldn't want to argue with zombie Edgar Allan Poe either. But I think there's something to that, that in a short story that gets written in a single sitting, and you want to have it accomplish something in the reader. First thing, you got to engage them and entertain them, because if you don't do that, you'll never get anything else across. But figure out what it is, what's your message, what's your moral, what's your theme, and just hammer on that from a lot of different perspectives. I have a quote here that I brought from him, because it helps me. So his words, paraphrase: having conceived with deliberate care a certain unique or single effect, if the author's very initial sentence tend not to the outbringing of this effect, then the author has failed in their first step. From the first paragraph, set up the entire message of the story. You're dealing the cards that are about to be played, and everything else there gets played. It's helpful as a through line for the story that if you know what that single message and effect is going to be, only write that. It saves you all the distractions of other stuff.
What's your next question? Because we're getting a lot of background noise, which would be helpful. But we have another caller. Who is calling?
Hi, this is Rick calling from Nashville.
Okay.
Hi.
Bob.
I wondered, when you speak about authorial voice, in your own stories, does it remain consistent over stories, or does it change over stories?
Okay.
Is it consistent, or does it change? And I think the answer is it changes because I pay attention to it. When I go back and read my first couple of stories, there's a lot I can recognize in there. But like my first story, which was in this totally obscure Canadian web journal that put out two issues and folded, and it's more distant. There's some humor to it, but I don't think I could rewrite the way now if I wanted to. I've written a lot more words, and hopefully I'm getting better at it.
Yes.
That was good time. Please join us again and check out Writers Online Network, a very exciting venture. It's writersonlinenetwork.com, and find out what you can do. And we hope to see you next month, third Monday of the month at 5 o'clock. Thank you very much. Bye, everyone.